The color green takes over when you travel the countryside to the Mekong River Delta. Banana trees, rice fields, long, slim boats bob on slow, brown rivers. Saigon, that striving, busy city, seems worlds away. On the grounds of a centuries-old Buddhist pagoda, the spires of temples spike to the sky. The surrounding villages hold simple, spare homes with palm-thatched roofs. But there is striving here, too, often involving water. A network of man-made canals delivers fresh water from the rivers or gives access south to the sea. And then gates and walls and levees control water throughout the delta. The area has 20 million people and growing. Even the rural cities have traffic. We got a guide. Tim Gorman helped decode the land and how people use it.
You'll find a mix of rice farming and shrimp farming, saltwater shrimp farming. Breakfast is arriving.
Breakfast is fried eggs with fresh French bread and thick Vietnamese coffee with that sweet condensed milk. Tim is getting his PhD from Cornell University, looking at big water engineering projects like levees and gates, not from a technical side, but whether they work for people.
You could build the best system in the world. You could build the best system of dikes and sluices for water control or dams. And people might respond to these interventions in really unexpected ways.
Unexpected ways that muck up the best laid plans of governments or engineers. We get on motorbikes. Tim, a very tall man with very pale skin, slathers on extra sunscreen, and we head out for examples. Across a bridge, we wind down a side street that follows a body of water about 100 feet wide. It's a man-made canal that goes to the sea. Tim points to big cement columns that support a huge metal gate in the water, the Lang Chom Gate.
It was constructed in the 1990s with the idea of blocking the flow of salt water from the ocean and protecting this canal and making it possible to grow rice all year.
Growing rice all year is a big deal. The communist government had sent people to the Delta to farm rice after the war. But with the natural cycle of fresh water during the rainy season and salty seawater during the dry season, they could really only grow enough for themselves. In the 1990s, Vietnam's economy opened up. This gate was part of a bigger system of water control.
This is one of their big kind of big ticket projects, tens to hundreds of millions of dollars.
And it came with a clear message. Hey, we've spent a lot of money to keep this salt water out.
And from here on in, you're supposed to grow rice.
Officials banked on this, on getting two or three crops of rice a year. The farmers would make more money. The nation would have more rice. Win-win, right? Except by the time the gates were finished,
people had actually switched in this area, for the most part, from rice cultivation to saltwater shrimp farming, mostly of black tiger prawns. And so they built these big structures with the idea of protecting all of this land from saline intrusion. But by the time they built it, people didn't want to be protected from saline intrusion.
The farmers had turned their freshwater rice fields into saltwater shrimp ponds. They had adapted. If we can't keep the saltwater out, let's use it. Shrimp prices were good. Forget rice. Two middle-aged women, Ut and Mon, sit in the shade nearby the gate. They sell soft drinks and snacks. No last names. They're about to tell a controversial story. Ut and her husband were among the many people who couldn't easily get salt water for their shrimp ponds when the gates closed. So in 2001, her husband's friends dared him to protest. Tim and research assistant Kiem Nguyen translate.
First, four people showed up to demand that it be open and that they let the salt water in. And after that, it kind of snowballed.
1,000, maybe 2,000 people gathered to pry open the gates, but they couldn't. So they started digging around the gates to let salt water in that way.
So they were camped out there?
They were camped out, and they were like apparently like staying there in shifts, 3 8-hour shifts. So there would always be a big group there, always awake.
The women said it was fun.
That it was really fun. Cooking food for all the protesters, and some rich person donated all this food for the protesters to eat.
They sang songs, including the communist anthem from right after the war. Now, Tim can't emphasize enough how rare this is, any public display, much less a mass protest in communist Vietnam.
How long did that go on?
They said 3 or 4 days before the authorities finally negotiated some sort of deal. And they also said what was really interesting is that they said that in order to prevent the police from arresting people or the authorities from shutting the protest down, they had women kind of form a front line, mothers who lost their sons during the war and also wives who lost their husbands during the war on the revolutionary or communist side. And so they were kind of unassailable or untouchable, so the cops couldn't move past them.
To keep the protesters from destroying this hugely expensive gate altogether, Vietnam's prime minister got on the phone from up north in Hanoi
and negotiated a deal where they would open up the gates and allow the salt water to flow back in, which satisfied the protesters and they dispersed. Since then, the gate has been open pretty much.
Better community engagement that factors in the economic realities for locals. Tim Gorman says that can avoid major spending on projects that ultimately fail. And that's important as the Delta faces sea level rise. If the sea rises 1 meter, the UN Refugee Agency says 7 million people here can't live where they live now. Professor Lê Antoine studies water management at the Dragon Institute in the Delta. His focus is smaller pilot projects with local farmers. Can they store more rainwater for rice or do a mix of rice and shrimp so they don't turn the soil too salty? His department gets farmers together.
So usually we try to do it from bottom up. The farmers come to have their own discussions.
The scientists just listen and explain.
Which option will entail, like, you know, which consequences?
They try things, a little at a time, see the results. This approach doesn't assume any particular outcome is bad if it's what people want. Because saltwater may keep locals from growing more rice or even swallow their homes in a storm one day, but it's also a resource.
Yeah.
Riding along a coastal highway with Tim Gorman, we stop short at a mansion under construction. Because it has this sort of family crest at the top. It's the owner's initials, with 2 shrimp and a pot of gold between them. The wife is there. She tells us about the home, but she doesn't want to give her name. It's surrounded by a dozen or so huge shrimp ponds, these dirt pits lined with thick black plastic and fans to aerate them. This is a big operation, says Tim.
I'm guessing $100,000, around a couple $100,000 a year here, which is a massive, massive income for Vietnam.
As she stands there in her gold earrings and matching green outfit, we're thinking new reality TV show, Shrimp Wives of the Mekong Delta. Tim is thinking climate change.
So probably those ponds down over there all used to be forest land. And what's happened with the boom in shrimp production is it's made this land valuable.
More valuable than leaving it as forest to protect the Delta from storms. Even though in 1997, a typhoon killed thousands of people here. And storms like that are expected to increase. There are other downsides. Shrimp farming speeds up degradation of the land, turns the soil salty, emits pollutants. Plus, it's risky. People often go bust, lose their land when the shrimp fails or the price of shrimp drops. Still, it's a tempting bet. Further inland, we find more construction. Not a house, but an excavator digging a new shrimp pond. The woman on site, Sao Van, is in the traditional Vietnamese conical hat. She says her family's tried a few things on this land. Rice, a little bit of shrimp, but now they're going all in.
They're digging this out so they can do intensive shrimp all year.
The woman hopes the investment works to fund her children's education. Her kids will likely leave the Delta to go work in the city, and she wants that for them. Tim Gorman says people here largely understand the risk of rising water in storms. They can take measures to adapt, like moving, gradually, which may be more realistic than big promises and big protection.
Probably hundreds of billions of dollars or trillions of dollars of investment to protect the entire Mekong Delta from long-term sea level rise. You know, nearly impossible given the resources that Vietnam has.
So rather than chase huge sums of money for the nearly impossible, if some of the coast is going to be underwater anyway, why not see what happens? It's a radical idea, especially with the urgent action messaging we're used to hearing around climate change. But some of the experts we met in the Mekong Delta think of it this way. People are like water. They'll take the path of least resistance. Listen to them, and you can create ground-up solutions that help them get where they want to go, rather than forcing them, like a levied river, into an engineered route. For WWNO, I'm Eve Troeh.